Hello and welcome. We're very pleased to be asked from the Lowy Institute to be part of the NGV triennial event. It's a real honour for the Institute to be involved in all this. My name's Daniel Flitton, and I was looking as I was coming along tonight at the bios that someone has very nicely put together for me, which I should have paid more attention to because it described me as one of Australia's most senior foreign affairs journalists, and I figured that just means that I'm old. I'm getting older. So I was thinking about, like, on the way I was thinking about power dynamics, because we're going to talk about power tonight. And I thought to myself, as humans, we're innately aware of power in all of our social interactions. And power is something that is always relative. I have a three-year-old who has immense power. If you think about more than just family dynamics, though, at all levels of our society, whether it's in the workplace, and I once worked in universities, and people talk about office politics, but there is no politics like the politics of who gets an office. But we think about power in the workplace or power at our social community levels, state level, national level, or what we're going to talk about more tonight, the international level, all of this is interrelated. We often used to hear this phrase about the most powerful man in the world, which used to refer to the US president. Maybe it still does. Think about that. Some years ago, I was a press gallery journalist up in Canberra. And one of the biggest treats I got to do is, as far as coverage went, was to travel with the then Prime Minister Julia Gillard to Vladivostok in the wild east of Russia to cover a regional leaders' summit. And the display of power that Vladimir Putin, who was the host at the time, was really quite something extraordinary to behold. He arrived not flying in a kind of Air Force One equivalent. He flew in an ultralight aircraft with a flock of geese. That was the way in which he wanted to present himself. He was at least wearing a shirt. He arrived with his flock of geese. The venue was an old Soviet-era naval base, Rusky Island, I think was the name. It was just off Vladivostok. He spent $18 billion on hosting this event. He built a bridge as big as the Westgate down there in order to link the island to the mainland. And he flew in young Russian volunteers from all over the country to serve as sort of chaperones around the island for all the visiting dignitaries and the journalists. And it was all to display a notion that Russia was very much a power in this region, in our region, into the Asia-Pacific, or as people have come to call it in recent years, the Indo-Pacific. Or at least that was the hope that Vladimir Putin wanted to display with his ostentatious displays of power. To discuss all of this sort of thing tonight and how these interactions are happening in our region, I'm very, very pleased. I'm Melbourne-based. And I'm very, very pleased to bring a series of excellent colleagues down from the Lowy Institute to Melbourne to speak to us tonight. We're going to be talking about power interactions in the region, how these dynamics have unfolded in recent years, how it operates politically and strategically with growing wealth, influence, and the military weight of a new and revived Asia. Joining me here, Hervé Lemieux is a research fellow in the Lowy Institute, leading a project for mapping the distribution of state-based power in Asia. This is a major publication that the Institute is undertaking, which will be launched later this year. And while we might be able to give you a little bit of a sneak preview of it, some of it's still being worked up, and Hervé will be able to talk to you about that. He grew up in Myanmar and started his career as a Southeast Asia analyst at Oxford Analytica prior to joining the Lowy Institute. Meriden Verrill is the director of the East Asia program at Lowy. And before joining Lowy, Meriden was an assistant country director and senior policy advisor with the UNDP in China. She spent 8 years living and working in China. And finally, Ewan Graham is director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. And Ewan has been a close observer of East Asian security affairs now for more than 20 years in academia, in the private sector, and worked for the British government spent some time in Pyongyang as well. So I'm very pleased that my colleagues have been able to join us. And you've just excuse me one moment of awkwardness. I'll move over here. And we'll have a discussion a bit over half an hour, perhaps 40 minutes, around the power dynamics that are unfolding in the region. And then what we'd really like to do, though, is to throw it open to questions to hear what you would like to talk about too. But Hervé, if I can give you a chance to plug the report that's coming up and perhaps to set the scene a little bit for us, how has the region begun to change? What's the shape as you see it?
Sure. So one of the things that we're doing, and I should probably premise this by giving you a definition of power because it's often so elusive. So the way we define power is the ability, the capacity of states to influence or direct other states, non-state actors, and the course of international events. And that's very broadly phrased. We've identified 8 types of power projection, and these we're trying to map the distribution of power. And in that way, we're looking at really the ability of countries to project themselves across different means, different dimensions of power. Some countries are consistently good. Other countries are going to be variable. Some countries like North Korea put all their eggs in one basket, which is military capability, and they think that that's enough. Other countries choose influence over their resource base. But really, what's happening in Asia has its root causes in 2 factors. I mean, first is 50 years of extraordinary economic development, right? 3 out of the 4 largest economies in the world are now in Asia. In 2014, China became the largest economy in the world. And, you know, just to show you how remarkable that was, United States had become or was the largest economy since 1870. So that's 144 years of unchallenged economic dominance in the world, suddenly changed in 2014. And behind that story is the numbers, the sheer scale of Asia, the demographics. 2/3 of the world's population by 2025 will be in Asia. If you put together the entire population of the European Union, the 25 countries, including the UK still, and the United States, there'll be less than 1/10 of the world's population. So we have this juncture, really, between the richest, most affluent societies in the world no longer being the largest, most powerful economies in the world. And that's a very new thing to our international world order. And I don't think there's really any turning back on these demographic and economic trends. Sure, China is vulnerable to political and economic episodes of instability. We all know that India is notoriously hard to govern. But then let's not forget that the West's ascendancy was also marked by extreme periods of instability, like the American Civil War, like the Great Depression, like both world wars. And that didn't stop the West from ascending. So I don't think we can necessarily say there's a turning back. I mean, the cards have already been played. This is where we are. However, there is a discount effect. That is to say that powers that now have a lot of economic resources, so let's take China. In 2014, it became the largest economy in the world. That didn't automatically make it the most powerful country in the world. And that's because the US retains a diplomatic, military, institutional edge over China. Power is more than the sum of your resources. Power is in how you wield and how you exert your influence in terms of your diplomatic networks, in terms of your economic relationships, in terms of your cultural influence. And these are decades in the making, right? So it's a game of catch-up for what we're calling the underachievers, those with large resource bases, but that underachieve in terms of their influence. And for the overachievers, which are the countries with still large amounts of influence on the world stage, even though they have a declining share of the resources, the challenge is really how do you can be a smart power, but historically speaking, when you look at, for example, the British Empire, it was unable to maintain its global commitments because the strength of the British economy couldn't sustain it anymore. The Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight because its military spending couldn't keep up, or its economy couldn't keep up with its military spending. So at some point there is, in the long run, a causal relationship between having resources and wielding influence. And the balance is really fine at the moment in Asia. What we see is that the United States still is the predominant military power. China is the larger economic power, so resources are already divided. In terms of influence, though, Washington is at the center of this alliance system, which is unmatched and is a real source of, it's a force multiplier on its military capability, which is already sizable. Now, what China brings to the table is a large economy and economic relationships, and that's its most durable and most pronounced form of influence to date. Where it still lags, however, is in cultural influence, is in that kind of institutional multilateral power, and is in its the development of diplomatic networks which require trust in the region. So we're in this strange interregnum at the moment where the West still has disproportionate amount of political power in the globe and even in the region, while emerging powers like India and China have the economic resources but are still finding their way in terms of their influence.
I just want to bring Merit in on this too, particularly on Hervé's talk there about the issue on with regard to China. And from your perspective, do you think that China is... How is China trying to respond to a perceived power lag? Is it trying to reshape the region? Is that the right way to characterise what's happening at present?
That's a really big question. Thanks. The question of whether or not China is trying to respond to a perceived power lag presumes that China sees a perceived power lag. And what we have to do, I think, when we're talking about China is try and understand how they see the world and their role in it. And it's not the same as how we see the world and where China sits in it. That is not to say that China is not trying to increase its voice and role in the world, but it's not exactly comparable to talking about, say, the US influence. I think we can sometimes get caught up in looking at it as one of those zero-sum games where, you know, the US has got this much influence, China's got this much influence, China's trying to push up as perhaps the US is going down. China doesn't see it in quite those comparative terms. That being said, China sees the world, the world would be a better place for it and for everybody if it had some more voice in that world. But it looks at it in more of a kind of concentric circles sort of structure. So China in the centre of the concentric circles, and Southeast, then East Asia around it, then Southeast Asia around that. And where that's where it primarily wants to focus its influence. And that draws on a historical understanding of the way that China has worked in the world in the past, this idea of a tribute system. Now, the concept of a tribute system may or may not have any historical accuracy. That's a different question. But that's the kind of mindset that the Chinese are working with at the moment. So they have this view that that history will prevail, that there is a natural re-emergence and rejuvenation of China, that that's going to mean that they're going to have more influence in that kind of concentric circle model. But what that influence and power looks like is also something we need to think about. It doesn't necessarily mean that they want to have any influence over the systems of government or how people operate with their systems of rules of law or human rights. So what China means by power and influence is also different, and we need to keep that in mind too.
We'll undoubtedly get on to talking more about influence. It's been a big part of the debates in Australia recently. Just before I bring Ewan in, Ewan, I didn't mention, is also a specialist on maritime issues in Asia. So given the focus that we've had on the South China Sea, terrific to be able to draw on his expertise on that. But Meriden, just before we move on, one of the things that you undoubtedly the audience has heard this term soft power, it's this notion that's become popularised in the last 20 or 30 years or so, and this idea of sort of the cultural draw of a country, the ability that a country has, whether it's with Hollywood or Bollywood, to be able to draw attention and goodwill. From China's perspective, how do they see soft power?
China's been thinking about soft power in various forms quite a long time. And there's been a lot of internal debate in China about what soft power is, how best to use it, what you can try and get out of it. And generally speaking, that kind of agreed view, or at least the official view now, is that China's culture is the best way to achieve soft power. The real fundamental definition of soft power is getting others to want what you want, not just convincing others that you're nice or kind of making them do what you want in some sneaky way, but getting them to want what you want. Now, China using Chinese culture doesn't necessarily achieve that. It might get countries to think China's a bit nice, a bit less threatening, but that doesn't necessarily achieve soft power in that real form. So China's got a really long way to go, I think, in really understanding how soft power works, how it can achieve it. It's still using a very top-down kind of model. It doesn't really get the idea that soft power has to come from the ground up to be really effective. It uses its media as well as a kind of tool of soft power, but Chinese government-sponsored media is not generally very effective at achieving those goals. So it's something it's aware of, but not particularly good at.
Ewan, can we perhaps broaden this a little bit beyond just the China dynamic in terms of the region? How do you see the debates around power unfolding at present, if power is always relative in the sense of someone wins, someone loses?
I think the US-China dynamic is the dominant one, but it can lead us to the exclusion of other players. And I think for a middle power like Australia, always having to sort of look up as a middle power is not a healthy paradigm in which to sort of frame one's national security or foreign policy choices. And I think the soft power equation is also relevant to this. What makes Asia maybe different from other regions is this sort of paradoxical nature where we have suppressed historical issues, military modernization, geopolitical nationalist rivalries, very intense, in which is constantly the source of questions to me: when is the next conflict going to happen and what will it look like? And yet the conflict hasn't happened between states for more than four decades. And that's an interesting state of affairs. It marks East Asia in particular as rather distinct from certainly the Middle East, which would be the obvious record winner for numbers of military conflicts between states. But even in Europe, Africa, we've seen more incidences of state-on-state conflict. So I think the question of who's up, who's down in Asia is harder to pin down. I think the relationship between economic power and military power is also blurred in a way that maybe it isn't in other parts of the world. And the contest about framing one's power to attract, which gets to the points that Meriden was making, I think, the contest is we see it, it's indivisible from what should be on paper straight-laced questions of economic infrastructure, the Belt and Road Initiative, and yet clearly very difficult to get that unpicked from all of the sort of geopolitical freighting that goes into it.
Can we try and unpack some of that? Because I think that will be fascinating for the audience, because frankly, I think a lot of people still don't quite have a handle over it, and maybe we don't either, on the rationale behind the Belt and Road Initiative, for instance, and how it's capturing attention across the region. And also too, and I wanted to get you talking about this, but please everybody chime in. I think it was Dennis Richardson, who was the former Secretary of the Defense Department, said clearly China is not building these artificial islands out in the South China Sea as holiday destinations. I mean, what's the purpose? Why this sort of thing? In a sense, a very real territorial game that we haven't seen around the world for so long, ever since the end of colonization, really.
And perhaps analogous to what we've seen in another part of the world, where we've had Russia annexing territory. That, yeah, that crosses a red line in the whole post-1945 compact. And what China has done, Meriden may disagree, I think could also be labelled as a creeping annexation, because it has that territorial aspect. It moves the line of what China claims as territory, although there's an ambiguity about what the nature of that claim is. Things are always defined in official Chinese statements as the relevant waters or adjacent. And of course, it's left in the eye of the beholder. In a sense, it's up to them to defer. And that's a kind of clever psychological game that I think China plays with in that ambiguity. But there's a hard-edged dimension to it too. Now, just to take the South China Sea islands, although legally speaking, they're not islands. We had a legal judgment of that 2 years ago that said they're rocks, which means they can only claim small territorial seas rather than large economic zones. But I think nonetheless, what is China trying to do by this? Well, there's a military dimension to it, but if we were to get into a high-intensity military shooting war, those islands are actually quite vulnerable. There's a lot of concentrated infrastructure that could be targeted very quickly by the US and its more advanced allies, that maybe that's not a pure power play. Maybe it's a dominance play for the other parts of the region. That's where I think your question, where we started, not to look at this purely in binary US-China terms, but what China may be doing is to actually sort of seed the idea of a sphere of influence that has a reference to the old tributary system, and psychologically, without having to fight, to establish that kind of habit of hierarchy and deference amongst the smaller rivals and players. Where I think, I think Meriden, I'll leave it to you to come in on where you think China's motivations lie on the Belt and Road Initiative, but the weakness in China's power of attraction, surely, is the fact that it's ethnocentrically defined. So whereas the United States, for many years, was able to attract the talents of the world by providing an open, anyone could become American.
The melting pot.
The melting pot. The weakness in China's model is that there is an implicit pact that China offers, but it's not one that you can never become Chinese.
All right. So trying to tie those things back into the question of power, thinking about the Belt and Road Initiative and also this idea of the South China Sea and these rocks and islands. There are some islands there. And this issue of Chinese attraction. China's Belt and Road Initiative was something that was officially brought into existence in 2013. It's a particular project of President Xi Jinping. But at the time, it was a kind of agglomeration of things that were already existing, putting them together, labelling them, you know, Xi Jinping pet project, big smiley face, big tick, and everybody's keen to get on board within China. There's a lot of incentives and motivations for Chinese actors to get on board with that. How successful is it as a power actor? can be as successful or as unsuccessful as, for example, Chinese aid and infrastructure development projects have always been. It depends on who's building them. It depends who's doing them. So again, it's a way in which China's trying to maybe achieve something but hasn't quite worked out the details of it. It's a great banner. It looks fantastic from the Chinese domestic point of view. It's certainly ruffled a lot of feathers in the rest of the world, but how much is it achieving in terms of creating influence, if that's what we're talking about, actual influence in these places? Some places, there is certainly some influence. So some places, there seem to be correlations, could be direct, between China's activities there and, say, voting behaviour or attitudes toward the South China Sea. But there's other instances where China is doing development projects or Belt and Road projects and those countries aren't voting along inside or towing China's line. So there's not a clear link. With this South China Sea stuff, this is what I was talking about with this kind of concentric circles of influence. The South China Sea fits into China's psychological, this humiliation narrative, where it really feels strongly that it was ripped apart in the mid-1800s because of the Opium Wars from foreign influence, and that it's got to protect itself from that ever happening again. And where did that come from? It came through the ocean. It came through up through the South China Sea. And there's a sense that China, from the Chinese point of view, and I'm not arguing that this is right, but this is just the Chinese perspective, that sovereignty and territorial integrity is so utterly integral to their identity that it cannot ever be allowed to happen again. And so those areas need to be an area where China has some control and has some power. Now, that's not the same as annexing part of the Ukraine. That's not the same as necessarily putting boots on the ground. So from the outside, that's what it might look like. But we have to understand a little bit about what that might mean in practice, and it may or may not actually have the same motivation behind it. So, and as Yuan said, this idea that China's soft power, its appeal is ethnocentric, it's true, and China has said until very recently it never wants to try and export its model of development or progress. It's been very aware, you know, when people talked about a Beijing consensus, the Chinese were the first to argue that that wasn't a thing, that there might have been a Washington consensus, but they totally rejected the idea of a Beijing consensus. Xi Jinping has talked a little bit about a China model more recently, but he has also, even more recently, come out and explicitly said we don't want to export any kind of model to anybody else. So China's in this really kind of confused mess of trying to get other people, to get other countries to want what it wants, to like China, to not feel that China is a threat, and yet the way it behaves is so sort of piecemeal and ad hoc. There are so many actors, there are so many competing interests. It's actually far more messy than we think it is from the outside, and the result of that in terms of genuine influence and power is still pretty patchy.
Okay. You come in on China too, if you like. But the other thing that I was hoping to draw you to is in the research that you've been doing, It's not all a China story. There are other countries that are rising in amongst Asia as well, which Australia needs to pay more attention to. We're about to see the Prime Minister have a one-on-one meeting with the President of Indonesia again, a country to our north that we seem to sometimes forget it's there, or remind ourselves that it's there when we're watching some horrible thing happening in Bali or whatever it is. India too, a country seen with an immense prospective power. If, and I think you said in your earlier remarks, a difficult country to govern. How do you see these dynamics unfolding?
Yeah, so I mean, just coming back to China very quickly, I think it's patchy, but that's how power works. It's on a case-by-case basis. It's always situational. It's context-driven. There isn't always a clear plan, but it's ultimately the outcome that matters, and along our definitions. Now, to turn to the other countries, I think half the point of doing this exercise and to have as many countries included in this index, 25 countries in the region, is to see where they stand in relation to the larger powers. Because ultimately, even the larger powers, if power is a relative thing, it's going to be defined by how powerful the middle powers are. And if middle powers exist, then they're defined in relation to smaller powers. So we need to look at all of these things. And what we find is that actually, in terms of this power gap that I just mentioned, which is that you know, power outcomes requires a combination of resources and influence. Some countries have outsized influence in relation to their resource base, and other countries have undersized influence, an untapped potential. Those that have the best results in the power gap, the smart powers, tend to be middle powers. They tend to be countries like Singapore, like South Korea, even Malaysia and Australia. And those that, they do better in relation to their resources than even the larger powers do. And part of the reason is that the larger powers are in this game of competing against each other for the affection of middle powers and smaller powers. But there's influence to be gained from that in being a middle power, particularly in the time of peace and stability. Why not accept Belt and Road Initiative money at the same time that you're accepting foreign assistance from the US? And you can still decide what you want to do. In other words, influence doesn't always flow from the largest to the smallest. In fact, there is a real situational advantage for smaller countries. And some countries are better at that than others, right?
So in essence, what you're saying is that people recognize that they're a prize and that they can play off. Is that?
And that there's a kind of hedging
yeah.
that takes place. And that involves a certain strategic culture, which some countries have because they're very foreign policy oriented. And another strange irony of this is that the smaller you are, the more conscious of the world you are. The more you have to engage in foreign policy, the larger a giant you are, you tend to be more inward-looking. So India, for example, the problem is it declares its look east policy and everything else, but essentially it's a multinational, multilingual empire within itself. And the bandwidth to deal with the region is actually quite narrow. It's notoriously hard to govern domestically. That's the challenge. Indonesia is a similar issue. Very large country. There's a huge potential for power projection, but we're just not seeing it because its attention is really focused on internal governance issues, on development, on corruption, on institutional strength, that sort of thing. And until they resolve that sort of stuff, they're not going to. Those issues. The state capacity to deal with power projection isn't just going to be there. In other cases, Vietnam, for example, incredibly strategic culture with a history of fighting wars with larger neighbors and coming out better, or at least making sure that the larger countries don't win, they do incredibly well and are very foreign policy oriented, and they do better in terms of their influence than you'd expect them to on the basis of just looking at their GDP or just looking at their military capability or just looking at their population.
Mm. You spent some time in Singapore. Why does Singapore... I remember Kevin Rudd getting very upset with Singapore at one stage because he had an idea for an Asia-Pacific community that he launched on an unsuspecting region back in the early days of his prime ministership, and Singapore became a bit of an obstacle to it. What is it about Singapore that gives it such clout?
Partly its location, and spatial location is an important enabler for power. Singapore happens to sit at the confluence of two oceans and is on the shortest navigational route between those big economic poles of East Asia and South Asia. And that, of course, was the rationale for establishing a colonial trading settlement there exactly 200 years ago. That hasn't changed. I mean, the earth has become flatter in the sense that communications and finance can move at the drop of a hat electronically, but still 90% of the world's trade moves by ship. So the importance of the port and access to open sea lanes and the global trading system that undergirds is part of Singapore's importance. But I think Singapore, almost to the point of cliche, always talks about itself as the importance of a hub. And this gets, I think, to something that Hervé was hinting at, that it's the more networked countries that actually profit and benefit both economically but also strategically. And I think economically we have to recognize is still the fundamental of national power. You cannot grow your military, you cannot be the security providers of the region unless you have the basis to sustain that. So I think Singapore has always made a clear connection between investing in military resources, but to what it defines as a cap on affordability, which in Singapore's case never moves beyond, I think, 5-6% of GDP.
Meriden, if you were an advisor in the Trump administration, talk to us about how you would describe the view of American power in the region now. I want to take this as a sort of a last discussion point for the panel before we open up for questions from the audience.
So I'm an advisor in the Trump administration, and I'm telling President Trump how the region sees American power.
Yes.
First of all, I'd tell Mr. Trump how splendid he looked and what a nice fellow he was. I probably couldn't speak for all of the broader region, but I could perhaps give a bit on China. When China talks about this century of humiliation and this narrative of victimization, it's very carefully politically constructed. And number one unfavorite country goes between Japan and America, and depending on what they need to do at the time. So the view of American power in the region is usually pretty constantly negative. And in fact, the Chinese word for interference, when you ask someone what that word is, they'll tell you, oh, it's ganshi, you know, like what America does. It's like the actual definition of interference in Chinese is America. So they feel like America's kind of a thorn in their side, but by the same token, they don't want America's responsibilities. They don't like American preeminence, but they don't want to take on the roles that America has to do. We were talking a minute ago about this idea of overstretching and countries collapsing under their own weight. And China's very, very aware of that. And that's something that it is very careful that it does not want to do. It wants to avoid. So while it wants to have this sense of deference from its neighbours and around the region, it doesn't want the responsibility that comes with that. So, Mr. Trump, and did I mention how smart you looked? You need to know that everything you do in China will be able to be politically manipulated so that it looks like you're doing something that's trying to keep us down, the Chinese.
How durable is US power in the face of structural change in the region?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. But I think, I mean, I started out quite pessimistically, and maybe I'll end on a positive note. There's a couple of key indicators to look at here. One is that quietly, the US has acquired energy self-sufficiency. That's not a position that China's in. China is incredibly dependent on maritime routes for its oil. It's working partly, the answer to why Belt and Road Initiative is to do oil and gas pipelines that go to Pakistan, that go to Myanmar, that circumvent across the Straits of Malacca. The warming up of ties between Russia and China, the old kind of Soviet frenemies, as it were, is also to do with energy. So China faces a long-term geopolitical issue to do with energy supply. The US doesn't. On top of that, China is surrounded by countries with whom it has either fought wars or has active boundary disputes, or both. That's not a position that the United States is in. So there's a geographic security to actually being geographically remote, just like the United States or Australia or New Zealand. And on top of that, have a look at the fact that the US dollar is still the global currency reserve for the global economy, which is a mark of trust in the status quo. So for those reasons, I think that actually structurally and in terms of the influence, the US can expect to maintain a global dominance for some time, and that it's an uphill struggle for China. But historically, it's only maybe a matter of time before China starts acquiring those assets. I mean, it's still figuring out how to do it. And how you play a game with China also affects the degree to which China wants to work from within the system and reform it or replace it with something completely different, like the AWIB or other mechanisms. But the region doesn't trust China, and that is probably the biggest asset. So the US's resources are global and they're divided, whereas China's resources are concentrated on its region. But the US's influence is still stronger, I would argue, than China's influence in its own region.
So I'm going to move to questions from the audience in a moment, but Ewan's flagging that he wants to ask something. And the other thing that hasn't come up yet, and perhaps this is something we can take from the audience, when Donald Trump meets with Kim Jong-un, who's going to be the power in that dynamic?
Okay, let's come to that in a moment. I just want to talk about the US in Asia, because the index, the power index, which Hervey and his team has put together, is not a global index. It's an index of power in Asia. And the United States is in a very interesting position there, because geographically, clearly, it's not in Asia. It's present in Asia, as American officials like to talk about, because militarily it's forward deployed and economically it's closely engaged. That's clearly a disadvantage in an obvious material sense. But it's also given the United States that soft advantage, because the United States has been accepted as the region's security guarantor for X many years, partly because it isn't there, because it can have a semblance of neutrality. Of course, there's a power motive to what the United States does. But the fact that it's not there disputing sovereignty and is immune from those direct neighborhood and maritime disputes other than it, the sort of the global systemic level, gives the United States those enormous advantages. I think to be a continued player, the United States will have to be forward deployed in the Western Pacific. Otherwise, it will not have meaning to be present as a power. But that fundamentally will have to flow from its economic position. And where the US is failing, where I think Mr. Trump needs all the advice he can get, is that economically, the United States is not in the game. It's just a message of rejection. And now we find ourselves on the cusp of potentially trade conflicts and trade wars when China is selling its incentives, which, if there were a choice, maybe other countries in the region would not take as their first selection. But in the absence, in that vacuum of US being a party to the TPP or other free trade agreements, looks narrowly balanced on one leg of a stool, which is the military one, and that's not the one that's ultimately going to be sustainable.
That's ruined Hervé's optimistic take at the end. But never mind. Thank you, Ewan. I want to throw it for questions, and I'm hoping that we have a powerful audience that can ask us some powerful questions. Just in the front here.
My name is Emily Rose. Thanks so much, all the panelists, for your interesting remarks. I've just come from living in China for just over a year, and a couple of years ago I was there for half a year, and have studied Mandarin and sort of seen the way that the West outsiders are viewed in both positive and negative ways, and I find it very interesting to hear how the language reflects the way that the politics is described both in China and the way that foreign politics is described in Chinese. And I find there to be a huge disparity in just the tone, you know. In Chinese, you talk about Chinese excellence and, you know, Ganshe is like, yeah, as you said, related to America. Given the disparity in how political affairs are described in China internally and about the West and how China is viewed and often generalised about, how can we, you know, you were talking about trust, how can we build trust given such different ways of looking at political systems and just how they're described?
How can we build trust between China and Australia?
Yes, China and Australia, and more broadly. I don't know, it's a very broad question, but...
Well, if Hervé gets $1 million for his earlier question, I'll take $2 million for this one. It's enormously difficult, particularly when I think both of our political systems at the moment are buying popularity by bad-mouthing the other. You know, we've seen it in Australia in various ways, and it's certainly very important in China. And going back a bit to Hervé's list of pros and cons for China and the US, another one that kind of slows China down is that everything they're doing is about the CCP. Everything is about the Chinese Communist Party. So they will badmouth Australia and or anybody else and keep trust levels low deliberately, because that means you've got a nice other. That means that we are a nice, tight unit. We are a family. The CCP is guiding us, and that is what it's always going to come down to as long as the CCP is in power. So while we've both got these kinds of motivations, it's incredibly different. But that's not to say that we can't have a productive relationship because we've managed it for quite several decades already. But it's really difficult.
Thank you very much. A very good session. But two issues haven't been mentioned, which I thought were fairly significant for the heading today. And that is, first, this decision to have president for life. I don't think we can just ignore that one. And the other one that always intrigues me is the huge holding of US-denominated bonds that China has. And that's also been ignored in today's presentation. Do you want to address both of those, please?
Does anyone else want to have a go? China, Xi Jinping, president for life, right. So as most of the audience is probably aware, that there's sort of a few positions of power in the Chinese government. The one that had terms put on it was the one that was president. You can be head of the military, that can go on for as long as you want. You can be head of the party, that can go on for as long as you want. But there was a limit to the presidency, and Xi Jinping's just overturned that, so now you don't have the two terms, total of 10 years. He still could have had the other roles and kept them going. The West is responding with a lot of concern about this, and it's argued that Jiang Zemin's faction is also trying to paint that in a very bad light within China, with not much success. But to what extent it actually makes any real difference is a difficult one, because even if he gave up president, as presidents did before him, I mean, Jiang Zemin held on to power and manipulated Hu Jintao the whole time Hu Jintao was in office, stacked everything against him so he couldn't do anything. So whether or not it makes a real difference to how power is wielded is I think, difficult to say. But it certainly sends a signal that he will be not brooking any opposition from anybody else anytime soon. In terms of China holding US-denominated bonds, I don't really have the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean,
but Hervé does, yeah. And Ewan does.
It's a quick one. Okay.
What a team.
It alludes to the fact that actually the US and China are somewhat symbiotically, joined up, and that there is a kind of mutual assured economic destruction.
I think Hillary Clinton once said to Kevin Rudd, "How do you get tough with your banker?" Or something
Exactly. Yeah. If either party decides that they want to go into a trade war or. But clearly, I think what China's ambitions now are to get its currency, the renminbi, working as a global currency. Because the moment you can do that, you can have debt in your own currency. You can have foreign borrowers who buy your currency as opposed to the position they've been in where they've bought U.S. bonds for so long. And what they're worried about as well is the great privilege, I suppose, for the U.S. is that given that the global currency is U.S. dollar, you can sort of create the conditions in which monetary easing, etc., it becomes easier for you to repay your foreign debtors. That's a position that China wants to be in, but that requires trust, the global economy's trust, foreign reserves across the world to trust that the renminbi is a currency that belongs to a country and institution that's going to be durable. And so far, they haven't had that vote of confidence, and that is also why I included it in my list of key indicators separating the US and China.
I'd say just on quickly, too, on the Xi president for life issue, and don't disagree broadly with what Meriden's saying, but it does become a catalyst, one of those moments where people really start to notice outside China. So as much as you're saying that the CCP is trying to maintain its sort of internal consistency and see off potential rival enemies within by creating another, it does cast China in a very negative light from the outside, is my only observation. Ewan, sorry, you wanted to chime in too.
So John Edwards, our non-resident fellow, a former RBA board member at the Institute, takes an interesting line on the economic relationship between China and the United States as diverging. Now, of course, China still holds a very large volume of U.S. debt, but it's deleveraging progressively. And I think that speaks maybe to a broader risk, and one also associated, perhaps the biggest risk, in my view, of U.S. presidents' world view is that it lends itself to a spheres of influence 19th century view of the world in which Russia can have its sphere of influence. China would have its sphere of influence, which would extend to Southeast Asia, perhaps even as far as Australia's environs. And then the American hemisphere, protected by a dome of missile defense, would be in its, back to a kind of throwback to Monroe doctrine. So that worries me. As far as President Xi for life, well, personalities count, as we found out, in spades, with the U.S. president swinging to a very extreme form of America First foreign policy, but in China too. Let's not underestimate that this isn't sort of just institutional forces around the CCP. This is very much a personalized drive. If President Xi is now caught in his own dilemma, where in a system without an opposition party or golden parachutes, you have to ride that tiger into the ground or you get eaten. So we know who we've got. We're going to be dealing with him for a long time. But clearly he's very ambitious, the most ambitious Chinese leader since Mao, probably. And he is in a rush to jump through that window and convert China's potential into power. And that is not an open-ended window, given the demographic bottlenecks, the environmental bottlenecks, the economic bottlenecks that are coming down the track.
But we don't know what Xi Jinping's version of power actually looks like. Anyway, I won't go there. There's more questions from the audience.
Yeah, no, great.
Thank you. There's been a lot of talk about rules-based order. What if old and emerging Asian powers intervene more to change the rules? That Japan and India seriously look at UN Security Council reform, that China starts trying to change through the International Seabed Authority the law of the sea. They might even ask the Americans to ratify it, for example. That people look at the World Bank and the IMF and say, why have they been an American or European-dominated institution and so on? That rather than setting up bodies like the AIIB, in coming years, will we see more interventionism from Asia saying, let's change the rules, let's change the global rules to benefit ourselves?
I was just going to say quickly that the most recent Defence White Paper, not the Foreign Policy White Paper, but the Defence White Paper a couple of years ago, actually says that the evolution of the rules-based order is something that it can accept and that's normal. Asian countries aren't the only ones who want to change some of the rules, who want to evolve the system. Brazil, for example, South Africa, for example, also think that some of the current rules in the rules-based order need to be revised, updated. There are ways of doing that are completely legitimate, and there are ways of doing it that aren't legitimate. Go,
yeah.
Power.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the key difference here, and maybe we're too quick to assume that what we're talking about is China replacing the U.S.'s global hegemony. I don't think anyone is in a position to replace the U.S.'s global hegemony, even if the U.S. loses its privileged position of global hegemony. I think we're actually seeing a splintering of power, right? We're seeing a balance of power as opposed to a global hyperpower. China will never be a global hyperpower in the way that the U.S. was, because the relativities are different between itself and the next largest economy and the ones behind that. So I think that's a key difference. And that means that the international order, it's fine if it's replaced by another set of rules, so long as there are rules. But actually what we're seeing is the fraying of the international order and it not being replaced by any one thing in particular. There is no Asian consensus on what the next rules-based order should look like. You can't speak of Asia in the way that we speak about the West, where there is a kind of neoliberal or democratic consensus from Washington to Brussels. It doesn't exist in Asia. The point about Asia is that you're dealing with a country that is riven by state-to-state antagonisms, and therefore Japan has its ADB and China has the AIIB, and when they feel like it, India jumps in and does the BRIC bank. But I mean, there is no consensus view on what should replace rules-based order, and at the same time, Western political order, everyone has agreed, is fraying, is undergoing a legitimacy crisis abroad and domestically, but there's nothing sustainable to replace it, and that's the real issue.
I think Nick's question also goes to this notion that you have status quo powers versus revisionist powers. But weirdly enough, some of the countries that we're talking about switch between both. So there are some, so on UN Security Council, for instance, where you have the five permanent members who can wield the veto. they're very happy and will sit there and will wield their veto in order to prevent anyone else from getting the veto. And so we're not going to see, we've had talk about Security Council reform endlessly, and we're not going to see it because the present status quo powers, some of whom are trying to be revisionist powers at the same time, like China or Russia or whatever, don't want to see change. So there's a sort of there's a slide between categories in all of that, which I think is the point that you're sort of getting to too.
Thanks. Recently we had some division in the Australian political system about the corrupting influence of China, with the Australian Development Minister referring to roads that go nowhere. How should Australia respond to the corrupting influence of China? Papua New Guinea, Pacific Islands and beyond. And I was in Laos in December, you know, where a couple of the businessmen in Laos were complaining vigorously about the same thing occurring in Laos as well.
I was going to say increase aid would be the first thing, but go on, Ewan.
One idea where Australia has a role to play and gets to the quadrilateral, the revived quadrilateral, and the idea that this could not be, in fact, shouldn't be a purely military-based compact between Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. But if it plays in the economic space, each has their own competitive advantage. United States has deep financial resources. Australia could do quality project management on infrastructure. India can compete on price, maybe not to the extent of China, but China's labour cost factor costs, of course, are continuing to go up. And Japan has done infrastructure probably more than anyone else in Asia and still has a leading role over China. So one practical suggestion would be for the four quadrilateral countries to coordinate their resources and make sure that they're out there offering a positive vision of infrastructure that won't compete on price with China. But if you actually play to your strengths in quality, then I think it gets to this power of attraction. You will find that countries in the region, if they're not bought off by brown paper bags or purely the corruption of the elite, if they're able to make a straightforward choice, will be prepared to pay for the quality, for the infrastructure that will have to serve for decades ahead and not just falling apart after a few years.
But I think I can...
Yeah, go.
Sorry, I was going to try and squeeze one last one in.
All right, just super quick. But we have to also be careful of the assumption that all Chinese projects are roads to nowhere. It's just not true. Some of them are very good, effective roads to somewhere very useful. Just
to the border, usually.
Hi. How do China's actions in the South China Sea impact the sovereignty of states in that region?
There is, I think, a zero-sum competition, and that gets to the problem. I agree with Meriden that sovereignty is defined very much as one of the two great legitimizing causes of the Chinese Communist Party, the other being economic growth. But where it runs into others' sovereignty in the South China Sea, there you clearly do see, I think, this increasingly hierarchical, coercive, from which countries in the region are recoiling. But countries like Malaysia, Vietnam, Brunei are not individually or even together able to counterbalance China. They need the other countries, particularly the United States, Japan, India, to also be playing their role, not necessarily in a direct military sense, but by supporting the institutions that was mentioned before. The Convention on the Law of the Sea is hugely important. And it's not just a military competition over sovereignty. It really is about the defense of an agreed rules system that without which will be a tragedy of the commons, which it will play out already in the South China Sea, which is one of the most overfished areas of water in the world.
We get to explore this fascinating topic a lot more, thanks to Harvey's report, which is coming out in
May.
May. So it's
it's great that we let you out of the cage to do this do this tonight, mate. But it's back to work tomorrow.
That's right.
In fact, tonight, isn't it?
9 p.m. flight.
Yeah, good, good. Well, get working. Thank you so much to everybody for coming out this evening. It's really great to have these sorts of debates. And, of course, we do this sort of thing in Melbourne all the time, our Sydney friends. This is our regular evening here. But, no, thank you. Thank you very much for all turning out. And if you could please thank the panel, you and Meredith and Harvey.